And then each one of my kids had their own meat purse that weighed about 25, 30 pounds.
Kids, so, that is the secret. Kids, I like it.
That is the secret.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. Straight to the point, no fluff, and no BS, this show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, please visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to the show, and thank you guys so much for tuning in. Tonight, our guest is Brian Barney. He was a guest last year, last summer, episodes 42 and 43. We talked about finding your next honey hole. I'll tell you that right up front, because if you haven't caught those episodes, it's a perfect time of the year to go back and check out those two episodes with Brian as we talk about finding your next hunting hole. It's the great time of season to be scouting, whether you're in Google Earth or have an opportunity to put boots on the ground, and those two shows with Brian will be helpful for you to do that. This time with Brian, we catch up. We just talk about where he's been last year, including some successful bear hunts, hunting Hawaii, which we spend some awesome time on. It's actually a possible DIY adventure on a budget, and maybe something you can even talk your wife into joining you on. You'll hear about it. You'll trust me. It can be a whole family adventure. We also talk about much, much more with Brian. He's just one of these guys that I absolutely love talking to because he's a do-it-yourself, just passionate dude, and all that passion comes over in these episodes. I'm sure you will enjoy them. Before we get to that, just want to say thank you to you guys for listening, for tuning in, for continuing to support the show. It's because of you guys that we do this. Specifically, thanks to Mike Kimball for leaving us a review on iTunes. Mike, we would love to send you some Exo Mountain Gear swag, so please contact us by email with your shipping information. That email address is podcast@exomountaingear.com. And listeners, we would love to have your feedback, whether you want to leave us a review on iTunes or contact us by email as well. We are always open to your questions, comments, and suggestions. All right, let's get into this episode with Brian Barney. Brian, welcome back to the show, man. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing great. Thanks, Mark, for having me on.
Yeah, dude, I tell you what, it's almost exactly a year ago that we had you on, and it was an episode, actually two episodes. We ended up breaking it into two parts. We had so much fun talking and got a ton of feedback. Listeners loved it, so excited to have you back, man.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, that was kind of the start, the first podcast I had ever been on.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, it was. And yeah. So I really got to give thanks to you guys for looking me up and having me on and letting me share, you know, on your platform. But yeah, that was a great conversation. I really enjoyed that. I always like talking about high country muleys, so that was a good one.
Yeah, for sure. Well, part of what I wanted to hear about and have our listeners hear about was you just mentioned it was the first podcast, which I didn't realize the first one ever you were on. But since then, I know that you've, with Eastman, started your own podcast. So go ahead and tell us about it, and I'm sure our listeners would love to learn more about it if they're not already listening.
Yeah, for sure. So you guys gave me my start and let me get on and share a bunch of tips and tactics. And I just overthink the world, and so I've got so many thoughts rolling around inside my head, and I'm so obsessed with Western hunting and have been for years and years. And so, you know, I've been thinking of article ideas, pitching articles to Eastman's, writing articles to Eastman's, and a podcast was just this platform where I could really let it all out. Everything I was thinking, you know, all the thoughts inside my head, all my overanalyzing, and I could put it out there. And so I was on your guys' podcast and a couple more, and it just kind of planted the seed that it was something that I wanted to do. And so I just kind of started off on my own. And when I first started, I did a lot of solo episodes just because I didn't have any guests other than my buddies and kind of wanted to get a start. And then from there, Eastman's partnered up with me. And they've just been great partners as they've really been helping me build a following to it. And so I've just really enjoyed it. I get one out a week is my goal. And sometimes it's Friday or Saturday by the time I get it out. But it's a, you know, and it's an evolution too. It's a learn as you go. And then all of a sudden you're trying to get better at conversations and better at articulating your thoughts and better at explaining things to your audience. So I've really enjoyed the whole process.
Yeah. That's super cool to hear, man. Yeah. It's interesting when you get on this side of it, on doing it, on making it, you realize how much work goes into it, how much you can try and put into it to hopefully have not only good content but deliver it well. And it's a fun process to continue to learn, as you know, we're right there with you trying to learn, you know.
Well, and audio quality and technical savvy are two big ones that I really lack in.
And sometimes it's just a pain, man. Like, you can do everything you know to do right and it'll go great one show, and then another show for whatever reason it blows up with quality, bad connection, something like that.
Oh, tell me about it. Yeah, you're preaching to the choir. Like, you do everything right and you monitor your audio, but every room is different and every guest is different and it's just like everything changes on every recording. And so, yeah, you'll do a few that'll be just perfect that you're really happy with, and then you'll get one that'll just throw a wrench in it that isn't quite as good of audio quality, and it just drives you nuts. But the more you do, the more you learn.
Yeah, for sure. Well, speaking of like the work and some of the hiccups, I was telling you before we hit record that Steve was running late getting on here, but it looks like he is online, so I'm gonna try and add him here, and then Perfect. We can both give him crap for being late, as well as the thousands of you guys listening. If I wish you could yell through the speaker to give Steve crap for being late, but let's try and add him on here and give him some trouble. Oh, by the time you show up, man, we're like already having an awesome show.
Being a father, man, things aren't as easy as they used to be.
Yeah, the record button has been hit, and I just told all of our listeners to yell back through the speakers to give you trouble for being late.
You're late by all of about 3 minutes, Steve.
Nice. Brian, how you doing?
Hey, I'm great. How about you?
Good, man. You ready for next week?
Yes, I sure am. Yeah, looking forward to it.
Awesome, man.
Yeah,
so it looks like you put a ton of work into it, choosing a good route and organizing everything. And yeah, I just can't wait to join in with all you guys and suffer a little bit.
Yeah, man, it's gonna be a blast. It's definitely. Yeah. I spend way too many hours than I'd like to admit trying to pick the route, because it's hard to make all the logistics work. But this is gonna be a fun one this year. We're gonna see a lot of animals and goats and elk and deer, and it's gonna be fun.
Yeah, so if your listeners catching on, we're recording this, June 29th, getting ready to take off on the death hike next week. Brian's going to come over and join us. Hopefully, listeners, you've caught... We did a previous episode talking about a bit, Steve and I, on, I think... what the heck do we call that? Something along the lines of embrace the suck, but on those words. That's actually one thing I wanted to chat a little bit about, just because we'll probably actually get this episode out right before the death hike, and then hopefully afterwards we're trying to do some recording while we're up there, probably not while we're huffing and puffing up the mountain literally, but do some post death hike debrief stuff. So anything pre-death hike, this would be a good time to chat about it. Brian, you didn't make it on previous years, right? This is your first time?
This is my first year doing it.
Okay, perfect. First year for myself as well, so we'll be the newbies trying to figure this thing out.
Just keep our legs going one in front of the other,
exactly.
And I think we'll make it.
One foot in front of the other.
That's the only rule.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to it. Anytime you can challenge yourself and do those long hikes, and it just times perfect with hunting season.
Yeah.
So it'll be great to get some miles underneath us, some elevation underneath us. And then it just looks like such a great group of guys, too. So it should be really enjoyable. Like I say, I've been looking forward to it for a while now.
Yeah. How many guys do you think we're going to end up with, Steve?
Roughly 20 right now.
Okay. Yeah.
We've had a few guys bail out with other, you know, just stuff popping up, and then a few guys jump in last minute. So yeah.
Sweet.
Roughly 20.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, it'll be a good time trying to do almost 40 miles and basically as quick as we can.
Yep.
Yeah. Sweet. Anything you want to add to that beyond what we covered, Steve, in kind of the previous episode? I think we hit it pretty good, but any other like relevant stuff to add to it as sort of a pre-Death Hike chat?
Man, no, yeah, nothing pops to mind other than just
I love Steve. Pain. Yeah, I love how you the prep email that you sent everybody, that was great with the gear list. And I love how you you said keep it light on all those early season scouting and these long extended hikes like this. It's all about keeping that pack weight as light as you possibly can. And we're only sleeping out for one night. And right. So you told guys to ditch the stove, ditch the mountain house, you know, that saves a bunch of weight. And then I think it was good that you told your pack weight in there that I think, you know, and I'm just trying to remember from the email, but somewhere around 16 to 18 pounds or something like that. But that's so critical when you're hunting those long miles or, you know, like us just hiking those long miles, is keeping that weight as low as possible. And of course, I'd love to have my pack 18 pounds for a 5-day hunt, but that's just not feasible. But for like an overnight trip like we're doing, I just thought that was really good how you stress that in the email, because all that weight on those guys' backs, it'll just fatigue them so much quicker. So I thought that was a great tip that you threw in there.
You're a big trail running shoe fan too, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I know, because I think that's a huge importance of at least to get the lightest weight boot you can, because you know, on a 40-mile thing, every little bit adds up. In fact, we're gonna have Rob Shaw. He wrote this cool article about just talking about the difference between a shoe and a boot and the amount of calories and energy expended just to go hike, you know, a distance. And it is a substantial number. I think we're going to have him on and talking about it here soon, because it's you know, at the end of the day, it adds up to the equivalent of hiking. I don't even know the number, but like 20% less.
Yeah. Right. They did some research and basically were able to kind of prove that, you know, adding a pound to your feet, meaning wearing heavier boots, is equivalent to adding many more pounds to your back. Like, it's not a one for one. Just because it's a pound heavier doesn't mean it's the same thing as carrying a pound on your back. Because obviously, if you think about it, your boot being on your feet, you're lifting that, you're dropping that all the time, versus a pound that's just sitting on your back is not being used in the same way. And so, yeah, it was pretty interesting that they had research and how they did it, and showing that a pound on your feet is really more like 7 pounds on your back or something to that effect. I forget the exact numbers, but it's pretty fascinating. So,
man, and I feel it in the mountains. I felt it firsthand, and mine was all in my head, but I've always repeated that. I think I've always repeated a pound on your feet is like 10 on your back, and maybe not quite. I've also read it's like 5 on your back, but whatever it is, it's substantial. And what I like to think about too is like, you know, and I go with the lightest footwear possible, and being a trail runner, I have really strong ankles, and so I can do gnarly terrain in you know, a low cut boot or even a tennis shoe. I never go with a breathable shoe because you get so much dust and debris in there, it just makes a muddy mess with the sweat. But I do go with a waterproof shoe, and those shoes, like for a set of those shoes, you can get them down to around 2 pounds per set. And the difference between a lot of these hiking boots will even be 4 pounds a set, or even our super lightweight one is 3 pounds a set. But think about that, is 1 pound on your foot, and you take, and you're hunting really hard, like 18 miles. You know, I'm not sure that'll probably be like 40,000 steps or 50,000 steps. Imagine doing 40,000 steps with an extra pound on your feet. That's 40,000 extra pounds you lifted that day with your leg lifts.
Yeah.
You know, that's crazy to think about.
Right.
Yeah, it's a substantial number. And I don't think enough guys, I don't know. I've just never understood the whole boot, like stiff boot, and thinking you needed to hunt that or hunt with that on your foot. It just doesn't make sense to me.
You're the same school of thought, Steve, where you a lightweight, like, do you use a mid-cut boot or a tennis shoe?
Yeah, I bounce back and forth. Solomon's fit my feet like a glove, and it's either the XA Pro 3D or I wear their X Ultra Mids. Depending on the hunt and timing of year, that's what I wear. So it's funny, same as you, because I would much rather not wear Gore-Tex, but the sweat and then the dust that gets through on the breathable ones makes it such a pain in the butt that I just opt for the Gore-Tex, and seems to work out the best.
Oh, doesn't it? Yeah, it just makes a mucky mess of your feet. You look at your feet and they're just black by the end of the hunt. And it seems like that grit seems to wear on your feet a little bit with the sweat too, where I think you just get, you get, your feet get softer and you're more apt to get blisters or to get sores on your feet or rub spots or hot spots, where the Gore-Tex, you know, even though they're not super breathable, they seem a lot more breathable than like a heavy boot. And they just work perfect for me. Wearing a good pair of socks, I don't get the mud in my socks and the sweat doesn't seem to bother me. But yeah, that's really cool to hear another backcountry hunter. And you do a lot of gnarly hunts like for goats and high country mule deer, and that you get away with that lightweight boot like I do. I just think that's the key to keeping the as least amount of fatigue off yourself as you can for those grueling hunts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dive into it, Brian. What are some of your specifics in terms of different footwear choices? Like, I'm talking actual brand model here, any particular preferences on socks, things like that, just for guys who might be wondering.
Yeah, so I'm like Steve. I like the Salomons. They fit me really well. I've used Merrells over the years. They do me good. I've been testing a few mid boots, and I like mid boots if they're lightweight. And like Steve says, on certain hunts, you know, they do give you a little bit more support around. I like a shoe because I stalk better in them, it seems like, but I don't know. So I am using the mid boots, and the mid boots that feel like a tennis shoe, that are a little bit softer, not quite as stiff, a little bit more give. They seem to stalk really well and be good in rough terrain. And so I actually tested a couple pairs of Crispies, Crispy Thor, and another one, I think it's a GTX or something like that. I was really psyched with those. Those guys are coming out with some really good lightweight boots. So I like those. The Zamberlins, I've got a mid pair of those that I'm really happy with. But I'm a Salomon fan too for tennis shoes, but everybody's kind of built different and ankle support's different too. And a lot of guys that aren't used to running, you know, tens of hundreds of miles a year in tennis shoes can't get away with it like I can, or like Steve can on some of these trails. And then as far as good socks, you know, I just wear like a good, decent, I don't get too thick of socks. I just like a medium thickness to them. And sometimes some of these hiking socks will have a little bit more pad around the heel or in the toe box. And then you just want something that's going to breathe and pull the moisture away from your feet. And so I don't go with cotton. Usually I go with like a merino wool on those socks, and they just pull the moisture away from your feet. So your feet don't get swamp foot. Like, one of the worst things you can do is swamp foot. When you hike mile after mile and you start getting your feet wet, they get soft, and then that's where you get wear spots and where you get blisters. And so it's important too that if you're really doing a ton of miles, to stop and pull those socks off. It's also important, if you feel any wear spot on your feet early in your hike, is to stop and relace your shoes. And there's different lacing techniques that you can pull away from that pressure point, because if you try to tough it out, that's where you get those really bad sores and then blisters, and then it'll just haunt you for the rest of the hunt. So it's really something you got to pay attention to and address in real time as it's happening.
Yeah, for sure.
That's good advice. Definitely on the death hike, that's something that you just don't mess around with. We change out our socks every freaking 5 miles, and, you know, just constantly checking for blisters. And yeah, because that would put you down in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. A big tough guy, and you get a little blister on your heel, and all of a sudden you're the biggest wuss in the mountains. Like, you just feel it every step. And like we were talking, 40,000 steps, it's 40,000 out every time you lift your heel, and it just cripples you on a hunt. You can't hunt effective once you get a blister like that. So it's really something that you got to monitor and pay attention, because it could ruin your whole backcountry experience.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's one thing. It'd be bad to have that midway happen with the death hike and have 18 miles to hike out, but it'd also be really bad to have it happen on day two or day three of a 7-day hunt and have days to go, you know. That's why you know, we've mentioned it so many times, but when we talk about like what pieces of gear are the most important, we're always going to put footwear up at the top, because like you just said, Brian, if that all goes south, like, it can just be crippling, you know. And sometimes you can't just will through it. To a certain extent you can, but it's going to affect how effective you are as a hunter, for sure.
Yeah. One thing, Brian, you mentioned too, that we don't hammer home enough, is, like you said, you like to stalk, right, in your shoes. And I've noticed, I mean, I actually tried a pair of Crispies too, and it's their Laponias, which it's a lightweight, flexible boot, but just the difference walking around my backyard in them, just a soft, flexible tennis shoe just makes so much more sense to me. You're so much quieter, getting off and on rocks, you know, your shoe kind of flexes and grabs the rock instead of trying to fight against it. But yeah, I think it's, just being able to, it's just so much quieter.
It is.
A guy walk in front of you with big heavy boots and you hear every footstep he makes and you're just in your tennis shoes back there and quiet as a mouse.
Oh, you're so right. Well, and there's different conditions that all use different stocking shoes, but the wool sock method for me in the high country, it just doesn't work just because it slips on your feet and you're in such steep terrain that it wants, you want to go flying off the mountain. It doesn't stick to grass. It doesn't stick to rocks. And then like if you're hunting elk or something like that, you can't keep moving with the herd. You always got to go back to your boots, or if that muley gets up and moves a few hundred yards, you know, you're thinking about where your boots are and going back. And so that's never worked really well for me. I've killed some deer in socks, but I just learned real quick that socks weren't the answer for me. And so I like hunting in my tennis shoes because, like you say, you can be quiet and that rubber sticks to rocks really well. Yep. And holds you there, you know, and it'll stick to steep terrain. And you can also be quiet. And if they're lightweight enough, you can feel the ground. And you want ones that aren't as stiff. You want them like a softer sole where they're not just crushing down on ground, sticks, grass, you know, where they're almost like you can almost step on your toes and then move to your heel on them. But yeah, I love stocking in tennis shoes. Another one of my tricks I use is, you see those, like minimalist, hippie running shoes, you know, those things are awesome for stalking. It gives you like another level of quietness and feel to the ground and connection with the ground. And I used to get the individual toe ones, but I swear I'm going to get beat up in the backcountry. Yeah, one of these days. So I actually went to one that encompasses my whole foot. And that way you don't get grass in between your toes and whatnot. But those things give you even another level of stalking ability. And they stick to the rocks really well. They stick to dirt, grass, and everything. So, you know, sometimes if the conditions are right, I'll put those on. Now, you know, traveling with an elk herd, if you do 3 to 5 miles in those minimalist shoes, you can bruise your feet. And so, you know, there's the right shoe for every condition. But I do find that those give me another level in mule deer country, and I'll actually pack the extra pound to have them with me so I can be ultra quiet on the stock. So I like those as well.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I've never thought, I've seen quite a few of those shoes and I've used a couple myself, but I've never thought of packing them and then using them specifically as a stalking shoe. That's pretty interesting because you get that grip factor. Yeah, that just makes a ton of sense.
Yep. And then Steve, your buddy, he came out with that stalking shoe, the stalker shoe. And those things work pretty good in the right conditions. Now, you know, they don't, you can't avoid cactus in them, you know, is there a downfall or anything sharp, and they don't quite give you the protection of the shoes or whatnot, but they are super quiet and they strap tight to your feet. And so you're able to really stalk quietly in those things. So I like those too. So it's kind of a toss up for what I'm going to bring on a hunt. But I do like to bring an extra set of stocking shoes, even when you're going ultra light. But tennis shoes, just for moving around country, traveling ridgelines, moving your camp, you know, and even stalking, and if you got a little wind noise, and even if you don't, tennis shoes are a great shoe to stalk in, and so much better and more agile than like a heavy, stiff boot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, before I forget, Brian, I wanted to go back to what we were chatting about a little bit with your podcast, and I just wanted to have you weigh in on, if we have listeners who haven't heard any of your shows, do any episodes come to mind as like a great place to start, other than just kind of going to the beginning, catching up, or checking out the latest episode? Are there any that you think would be a particular good place to start with listening?
Oh man, that's a tough question. I hadn't thought about that, but I've had some really good conversations of late. Dan Picard, we did an elk hunting episode. We really go in depth on elk hunting. I did a high country mule deer one. I think I did that one solo. I really had a good time laying that one down. Ike Eastman, that guy's just so fun to hang out with and be around. So, you know, if you like lighthearted and jokes and laughing the whole time, you know, that's a good one. Guy Eastman is so knowledgeable about hunting. So anytime I can sit down and chat with him, we get on a roll when we're talking hunting. And then a good one to check out would be with my hunting partner, Dan Heverin. So we laid one down called Extreme Hunts, and that's a really cool one as we talk about all the near-death experiences we had in our early 20s chasing high country mule deer and elk and just some of the hardships we've been through, lack of water and lightning storms and close calls and mistakes we've made over the years and also, you know, positive moves that we made and harvesting animals and some of the good hunts we've been on. So that was a really good one, you know, because he's a really good buddy of mine and a hunting partner, so that one we got on a roll too.
Yeah, perfect. And what's the easiest way to find that? Just search like Eastman's Elevated. Does that bring it right up?
Yep, Eastman's Elevated on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, all those platforms to have it there. So yep.
Awesome. I had to laugh that you mentioned lack of water in some of those stories because we had so many guys comment after the first couple episodes we did with you and you were talking about how little water you carried at times, just depending on, you know, if you're in the high country, you're just saying that you can make do on a very limited amount of water. And guys were like, is this guy a camel or what? You know?
Oh, I know. So I got more comments about that too. And I, you know, it was just something I said that I had never really thought about so much, but yeah, it sure grabbed a lot of attention to your audience. I was getting the same messages, but yeah, it's 32 to 50 ounces a day is what I can do when I'm running in that high country mule deer country. But yeah, it must just, you know, I'm a smaller guy too, and a smaller frame and in pretty good shape, but yeah, some of these guys would message me and say, you know, 50 ounces, I need 100 bare minimum a day, but we're all just built a little different for sure.
Yeah, and it's what you're conditioned to. Like you mentioned, you do a lot of trail running. You know, you're used to doing physical exertion, sometimes on, you know, that limited hydration. So I'm sure that in a way, yeah, the size plays a factor, but your conditioning does as well.
Yep, yep, I think you're right. Yeah, and I'm just fortunate I can survive in that high country with very little water. So I may be part camel in my DNA.
Perfect.
That's such a fun, I'm such a weight weenie and sacrifice every ounce I can, but conserving water has never been one of those that I've ever thought about. When you first mentioned it, it was kind of like almost a new idea to me, because really I've always just been, as much water as I can drink, I'm going to drink it just to stay hydrated, and I feel a lot better when I'm back there. You know, I try to drink 4 liters of water a day, at least on a minimum. And obviously we got to pack it up. We'll cut that down to like 2 to 3, but still that's, you know, it was kind of a new concept to me.
Well, and that's an important part too, Steve, is just hunting at your highest level and drinking as much water as you can so you can perform at your highest level. And so there's a lot of that goes into it too, where you don't want to cut yourself too short to where then you're not pushing as hard as you can, hunting as hard as you can, and put mm-hmm. yourself in danger, really. Dehydration, you know, is a major deal in the high country. So that you make a good point there as well. Yeah, those little seeps and streams that you can find up there, boy, those are just the lifeblood of the backcountry. If you can find like a little hidden spring up there, and right now, and even as it gets later, but a lot of it is just reading the grass and the brush and the foliage around those creeks and those seeps and those streams. But a lot of times, if you can find a secret one up there that's about 500 foot off the ridge, you know, nobody seems to know about it but you and the mule deer, and then you can survive up there in some of that country and be able to refill your water without having to dive 2,000, 3,000 feet off that mountain. And so I am always looking for those little seeps, both in scouting and when I'm hunting and when I'm sitting on a vantage point glassing. I'm always looking for those green spots and the highest place on the mountain I can get water, because that is the lifeblood of the backcountry when you're hunting high country mule deer, goats, or sheep, or anything like that.
Yeah, it's crazy how much water dictates your hunt. You know, it's absolutely everything. You run out, your hunt's done until you go find some more.
Yeah, absolutely necessary. Got to keep yourself alive up there.
Yeah. Brian, one of the things that we wanted to do just tonight on this episode is really just catch up and hear about, you know, the past year, really, since we've chatted. So I know that you've been in the field a ton. After multiple species, multiple locations. So if we could just get the ball rolling, what is something that stands out, positive or negative, a joy or a challenge from the 2016 season for you?
Oh, wow. I had a bunch of good ones. I'm just getting back from, I just did a Hawaii trip, which was really fun, hunting axis deer and goats and pigs out there, and had a couple buddies where I was just able to get a plane ticket and stay at their house and go up and hunt those. So that was just a blast, and hunted axis right in the heart of the rut. And it's just such good, it's such good meat, but it's also such good practice for bow hunting because they're such a wily animal. They're like a cross between a coos and an antelope. And so you really can't make any mistakes, but there's a bunch of them out there. So if you do mess one up, you know, it is in another hour or two and you've located another one that you can make a play on. And I was able to take my family on that trip and then, go hunt those with a couple buddies. So I had a great time over there and, brought home a bunch of great meat from there. So that was a really fun trip.
What island were you on?
So I went to Maui.
Okay. Awesome.
Nice.
And is it, yeah, is that year round they can hunt there? Is it for access?
It is year round.
Yeah,
yep.
That's
and
what
they,
I thought.
Their populations just do so good over there. The foliage is so high. There's so much good feed, but they compete for the choice grasses with these cattle that are on these cattle ranches. And so the cattle ranches, they really want you to manage the populations. And they also have goats there that were really fun. And you're hunting them up in the lava fields where the lava flow has come down, you know, and created the island, the last big lava flow. And so it's all this uneven lava rock, just ankle breaking stuff, but then this grass is growing over top of it and really steep, man, rough, rugged terrain. And you talk about water, so my 30 to 50 ounce rule went out the window out there. Oh my gosh, it's so humid out there, and it was warm and hot, but I have never been through so much water in my entire life. Every day in my pack, I'd add another water jug. I started out with like a 32 or 50 ounces, and every day I'd add another one. I think by the end, I was carrying about 120 ounces of water for the day. It was just crazy. And like there was one day, and this is a little crude, but I didn't take a pee for the entire day from start to finish because you just sweat so much. It's just crazy there. So you really got to keep the fluids coming in. But it was just a great time. Those axis deer were a great challenge. And I was able to get a nice trophy buck in the end. And I couple does and goats. And so it was really good time. But I cut my bear season short so I could go to Hawaii. So I hunted bears really hard and I had some buddies out and that hunted with me. And so I chase them spot and stalk in Montana. We're not allowed to bait in Montana. So it's all spot and stalk. And there's just fewer bears than they are deer and elk in the mountains. But spring is a really good time where their populations are condensed at a certain elevation. And, you know, it's kind of like us blue collar guys. It's kind of like our grizzly bear hunt or our dangerous game that we can all do and we can all afford. And so, you know, I really embrace that spring season. It opens April 15th and goes to June 15th. And so I always hunt it really hard. And it's cool because in my home valley, I can do a full day of work and then be out in the evening. And the evening is the best time to find them. And so I can hunt so many days and I can just focus on one species and put all my effort into it. And so I had a great season. I saw, oh, I think I was close to 30 bears or so. And I did, I passed two inside bow range, one a nice blonde boar. You know, it's just, I've shot enough big boars now that, you know, I really want something that's decent, respectable, something that I'm going to be psyched with when I kill them or when I harvest them. So I'm able to pass those smaller bears. I passed him and I passed another jet black that came to about 10 yards of me that, he was just a young one, just needed a couple more years. So I was really close and I did see some monsters and put some plays on them, but it just didn't work out. And the last night I had to hunt before I left Hawaii, I saw this giant jet black and just a great big boar that I wanted. And it was had like an hour left of light and the thermals had started coming downhill and he was across the canyon. It didn't take me 10 minutes to get over there, came right up on the bench he was, wind right down in my face. I was just sure he was going to be right there, and got to the top of that bench, and he was just nowhere to be found. And I went left in glass for him. I went right in glass for him. I still to this day don't know how he got away from me. In fact, that was my second to last night before I left to Hawaii. And so I wasn't going to hunt the next night, but I just had to because I knew where that jet black was. And I went back the next night, perfect vantage point, and he just gave me the slip. So he wasn't the first and won't be the last, but I do love that black bear season. It's just a thrill. And we were able to get my hunting buddy, Dan Heverin, we were able to get him a really nice bear. He came down, he hunted, I probably hunted maybe 30 or 35 days for bears. He hunted one day for bears and killed a nice boar. He came down and got on the vantage point, and we spotted a nice one and sent him for it. And yeah, he got over there and executed a great stalk and great shot on it and put it down. And so he was able to get that bear. So fun to be a part of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. That's super cool.
Spot and stalk with a bow. That's freaking tough on a bear.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. You know, they're meant for bow hunting, but you just don't get that many opportunities, and they move so much. And so sometimes you can't get them to hold still to get a stalk on them. But once you can get in close, it's just all about their wind. And Steve, you know, you have great bear hunting in Idaho there. But yeah, they are a real challenge when you go out with your stick and string and say, I'm sticking to this and I'm going to try to kill a black bear spot and stalk. But I say it's 95% boredom and then 5% pure thrill, you know. So I do, I'm hooked on hunting them, and now I've got the reward of hunting them, so I just can't quit.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's
so
cool.
So I guess that's 2017, so we're going back even farther than that. So the last time talked to you guys,
I definitely want to hear about 2016, but I have some more questions on hunting on the island, if we could, real quick.
Oh yeah, you bet.
Just because I know guys are gonna want to know more about it, for sure, you know, because that's something obviously not many guys have looked into. It's nothing we've covered on the podcast. So I just want to kind of anticipate some of the questions and love to hear more about that experience. Because believe it or not, hunting on the island is actually pretty doable. My elk hunting partner and I were actually looking at doing it. We were trying to convince our wives to go out there and turn it into like a this couple's trip. But the word got out that we would be hunting for part of the time, and we kind of lost some steam with our argument. But anyway, we'll get there one day. So you mentioned, you know, you can hunt the excess year round, but you're actually there for the rut. So I'm just kind of curious what their behavior is with the rut. What are tactics for hunting during the rut and things like that from a big picture view?
Yeah, so the axis deer love cover like a coos deer loves cover. I think that's where I got the tie to them, or where I tied them together. And they're super elusive, and they're really jumpy. They don't allow you to make any mistakes. And that's where they're like an antelope. Like if you even think about coming up over a rise, he's already seen you, you know. And if you can be hiking through the woods, and multiple times they just blow out in front of you because they hear you, or, you know, they see you. And so they're really wily, but there's a bunch of them. And so during the rut, and I actually believe the axis rut for almost the entire year. So I actually saw bucks in velvet as they were rutting hard, and he told me that those bucks will rut, you know, farther into July and August. So I think they do rut year round, but the majority of the rut, 75% of them, tend to rut around that June time. And when they rut, they're like any animal where the bucks let their guard down, and they're fighting with other bucks, and they're trying to herd their does together and trying to hang around their does. And they rut a lot like a mule deer, where they don't have a huge harem that they keep track of, that's their harem day in, day out. They wander through country and they get with a hot doe and they hang with them, and they may rut her, and then he'll move on or leave those does and he'll be going again. And they make a rutting sound. Now, I am horrible at this sound, but let me see if I can do it. And they call 3 to 5 times. And it sounds like a smoker's voice, just a, oh God, I'm horrible at it. But they make this sound that is one of a kind for axis deer. And I had this one buck, and he was actually a management buck that we wanted to take off there. And you judge them by their main beams. And if they start getting 30-inch main beams, that's a really big trophy buck. And in like a 22 to 24 would be a smaller buck. The buck I ended up shooting was 28, so a really good, respectable, you know, pretty close to a trophy. I mean, we're talking a couple inches difference. And so what they have is they have 3 points. They have brow tines, and then they have their main beams, and then they have a split. But they look like a small deer. The bucks are maybe 130 to 150. The does are 80 to 100 pounds. But then they have this elk rack that sticks above their head with 30-inch main beams. And so they look really huge out there. And it's like anything you get hunting, you get this appreciation for them and this respect for them. And then you start judging them and go, oh, look at that one. That's a wide one. Or, man, that thing's 30 inches tall. And so you just start to figure them out. But they really like cover. And us bow hunters really like to find them in the open. So you're trying to hunt the most open cover ground you can. But then it's like I like the spot and stalk style. Like we'd hunt deer, like we'd hunt anything out west where you get a vantage point, glass them, and then make a move on them and make a play. And so my favorite spot to hunt was a spot like that. And there was a spot way down low. And I mean, you're hunting right over the Pacific, which is just wild for us guys that come from out west. It's just like this different place on planet Earth. It's like a different world. You're looking over the Pacific Ocean with rolling waves, and then you've got all this lush grass and these trees, and then these axis deer. And these axis deer, they're spotted. They have these white spots on them, elk racks on their head. They're calling, and you can hear them. And once you start to key in where a buck is, then you start moving towards him and looking for him and trying to find him and see how big he is. But the more open spots were down low and up high where you're kind of just glassing openings and you'll run a master vantage point. But most of the time you're running a moving vantage point just because you can only get one view of country. And so you're kind of hiking through and glassing as you're hiking through, trying to pick these things out. And you can hunt them for the entire day. You spot them bedded, any piece of shade, you look under there and there's probably an axis deer laying there. Or you look at 5 spots and one of those spots will have axis laying under there. And so you're really looking at the shaded spots. And then it goes from that. And then we also hunted some thick cover. They call it the thick, and you just got to still hunt your way through it. But there's a bunch of axis deer in there, and the tall grass is really tough to hunt. But once you get inside the trees, like these trees, there's this nut tree. I wish I could remember all my foliage over there, but it has like an acid that comes down from the nuts that kill the vegetation underneath the trees. And so it's fairly open underneath the trees. So you get in that thick and in that cover, and then you're just still hunting and kind of glassing for spots and trying to pick them out. And I shot a doe doing that. And we saw some bucks. We saw a couple good bucks. I almost got a shot at one that was close to 30 inches that I was going to shoot. So that was a fun way to hunt them too. But it's just a different place and a different adventure on planet Earth. And like you say, it's feasible for us blue collar guys. I mean, for me with my buddies, they really saved me. And I would just bought a plane ticket over there for me and my family. They let me borrow a rig, stay at their house, take me to their best spots hunting. So, I mean, I was really fortunate, but you know, there are opportunities for guys to go out there and be able to hunt them. And it's just an awesome experience.
Yeah. So speaking of opportunity, what is the, like the land use, like I know you mentioned that there's ranchers who kind of want them under control. So is it a matter of getting permission to get on some private ranch land? Is there public lands over there? What's access like?
Yeah, so there's quite a bit of public on Lanai, and there's some public on Maui too. The problem is the state doesn't open up a lot of that public ground to hunting. So a lot of that public ground has axis deer on them, but they don't allow hunting on it. And so I'm not sure of all the logistics. I was just on a locals trip and running these guys' program, but there are trespass fees on some of these ranches. And so if you do a little research, there's also hunt clubs, and these hunt clubs allow access, you know, for a trespass fee or becoming part of their club. And then also just meeting some of the locals over there, and the locals on Hawaii are so nice. As you start to get in with those, I know my buddy from Eastman's, Dan Picard, he goes over every year. In fact, this year he went over twice. He went over once in the spring and then once during the Axis rut. I saw that he just killed a really nice buck. And he says Axis are his second favorite animal to hunt behind elk. He absolutely loves them. And I can see why now. I mean, I absolutely love them. But there isn't a lot of public ground on Maui. There's some public ground on the Big Island, and then there's quite a bit of public on Lanai. And then they also have a mouflon sheep on Lanai as well. And this mouflon sheep, you can hunt those every year. You just have to put in for a permit and they have a season. And so my Hawaiian buddies are trying to talk me into going over and hunting the mouflon sheep over on Lanai. But Lanai is all owned. It's owned by like one guy that owns all this, but half of the island he's turned into public land hunting where you can hunt wherever you want. And there's some old pineapple groves in there where they used to grow pineapples with a bunch of axes. And then the other half he opens up certain times of the year. And I'm not real good with all the logistics of it because, like I say, I had a locals, you know, trip over there where they really had me set up and took me to all the best spots. But you don't need any tags. All you need is a $100 Hawaiian hunting license you got to get before you go out there. But with a little research, I think guys could put a hunt together out there and hunt some ground and get into some deer.
Yeah, very cool. Sounds like a great place to do XO employee hunt, don't you think, Steve?
Yeah, it does.
All right, I'm in. You don't got to twist my arm.
you mentioned,
I'm not an employee, but I'll be a guest guide.
Yeah, you can do it. You have the experience, so we need you. Yeah. You mentioned the meat at one point. Two questions on that. One is anything distinctive about it, anything to compare it to? And two is I know that listeners are always curious about these destination hunts and transporting meat back. So how did you go that route?
Yeah, so the Axis meat, it's actually, gosh, it's just so tender and such good flavor. And I've heard from everybody that it's really good meat and some of their favorite or from different guys. And I'd have to agree. It's just so tender, such a good flavor. And I shot, it wasn't a yearling, but like a, it wasn't a fawn, but a year and a half old or a 2 year old or whatever. And their meat was a little bit lighter color and almost cooked almost like a pork or like a whiter meat. It was a little strange. We had something the other night that was just so good, but the meat and the venison, it just doesn't really have a distinct flavor. It's just, it's just really good high quality meat. And so we've been eating it like crazy. And so what we did to get the meat home, we had to be a little creative out there, but so we got these deer and between me and a couple of my Hawaiian friends, we butchered six deer the one night. And so we butchered them up. I took the best cuts of steak, the tenderloins, the back straps, and then some round steaks. I made some roast out of those. And then what I did is I vacuum sealed everything. And then the rest I made all into burger that we ground over there. Now they don't add any beef suet to any of their ground meat. And so, you know, I was just on their program and I said, okay, well, let's just grind it up. And we had a couple burgers while we were hunting and before we went out, and I had them and they were great. And so it's really lean meat, but so we just ground it straight and then vacuum sealed it. And then I was able to stick it into his freezer and freeze it. And then each one of my kids had their own meat purse that weighed about 25, 30 pounds.
Kids, so, that is the secret. Kids, I like it.
That is the secret. Yeah, so I bought like those bag coolers.
Your little smugglers. Yeah.
They really were, yeah. And so I bought like those purses or those soft-sided coolers while I was out there. And so we filled those with frozen meat, zipped them up, and then you know, I took a bigger cooler that I checked, and that was no problem. And then I also had my own meat purse, and then my wife had one. And so we brought a ton of meat back. And then my buddy had a great connection out there where he could trade deer venison straight across for fresh fish in one of the best fish markets over there. Oh, and wow. So we were able to trade a bunch for Ono, which is a wahoo. Which is just great fish, just slabs of meat. I mean, I don't know how many hundreds of dollars worth of fish it would be if you had to purchase it, but they trade it straight across because they love the Axis meat so much. And so he was able to trade and get me a bunch of fish as well. And so, yeah, we smuggled back a bunch of meat and fish, but everybody at the airport was great to work with. They didn't bug us on our meat purses, looked inside of it. It was frozen. We did 12 hours on the plane. I put them in the overhead bin or underneath my seat. Nothing melted, totally frozen when I got home. My checked cooler that I had full of meat, that was all frozen solid. Got home, it was frozen solid. So it all made it great.
That's awesome.
Meat purse is a whole new thing. That's going to catch on. That's my meat purse.
Yeah.
Let me know when we're doing this hunt next year. I'm in.
Yeah, for sure. I can bring some. I have two kids, so that's two meat purses that can be carried.
Oh, that's great. We got a team of smugglers. I'm ready. Yeah, and so the goats are really fun too. They live up in that higher country, and so they were really fun to hunt as well. And I was able to get a couple nice goats out there, one the first day I was there and one the last day I was there. And so they were fun to hunt. And they say the trifecta is to get a pig. And my one buddy over there, Janice, he loves pig. He actually liked pig meat more than he liked axis deer, is what he told me. Now the other guys were partial to axis meat, my other two buddies, but I did see some pigs. I wasn't able to get the trifecta. I wasn't too worried about it. I was having such a great time hunting axis deer and hunting goats and, you know, whatever I could find. But they do say the trifecta is to get a pig, and they've got those blades on their teeth that come up. So I think they're a Russian boar, all different colors. And I saw one smaller one, like a 40 pounder that wasn't worth going for. The first day I was there, I saw a pretty good one, but I had already shot a goat I was taking care of, and so I avoided that one. And then I saw this little one that would have been perfect as a pet for my kids. It was like this little tiny rugrat that I don't know where mom was, but it went to run away from me and ran up the hill and then fell backwards over its back and rolled back down the hill to about a couple of yards from me. So I think I could have caught that one if I wanted to, but I just let him be and left him. And then the last day, my buddy Robin shot a buck, and I stalked with him on the buck, and I had already shot one, and so he hadn't shot one on the trip, and so he shot a nice buck, and we were trailing that buck, and I had a pig, like about an 80-pounder, 100-pounder, come right over the ridge on top of me right there, and I just didn't have enough time to get a shot on it. But they do have pigs over there as well that eat really well.
Wow. Man. That's really cool. So going back to the fall, what's a lesson or a highlight that stands out from one of the hunts? I'm sure we could spend, you know, five more hours talking about a bunch of your hunts just from the past season, but what's something that comes to the top for you?
Yeah. So, it was my first experience last year, and Eastman's has been great. You kind of build trust with those guys and they give you more opportunity. And so maybe I mentioned it, but I was able to do my first couple of filmed hunts, and they haven't come out yet on Eastman's TV, but I think they'll make episodes. So, the first one was a mule deer hunt in Wyoming. And so it was just different, you know, having a cameraman and getting used to speaking into the camera and trying to capture a public land hunt for high country mule deer. And so I scouted really hard on that one. And so I had 8 or 9 days into scouting this new unit into Wyoming, and I had some bomber bucks located, but I was just looking for a good buck to harvest and try to get it on film was my goal. And so we actually harvested a really nice 4-point, the second day, able to get really good footage of it. And so that was really cool to pull that together and get my first one down on film. And, you know, those guys are paying for permits and paying for a cameraman and, you know, pay me if I'm successful. I don't know. I haven't seen a check yet, but I do it for free, I think. But I won't tell them that. But so there was a lot, some more pressure on the hunt, but it was really cool to try to capture that. And then, you know, now I'll be able to show my family and friends and show them the hunt and kind of what I go through. And it was a backcountry backpack. Packing hunt, you know, I had a really tough, good cameraman, and it was like teaming up with one of your buddies. You know, it's just you're the shooter, and his job is to get it on camera. And he was a really good videographer and had a really good artistic eye. And in that country, everywhere you look makes for good video. And so, I think it's going to be a really cool hunt. So psyched for that one. And then
was it just the two of you on that hunt?
Yep, just the two of us on that hunt.
Cool.
Yeah. So that was a cool one, that backcountry, high country mule deer, fun to capture that. And then I did one later that I did an elk hunt on. And so brought over, he's a new cameraman that works for Eastman, just a really good kid and really tough kid. You know, he could do a bunch of miles, and he was really hungry to get footage. He had never got a kill shot before. He'd been on a couple hunts with the Eastmans, but had never got a kill shot. And so we kind of teamed up. And again, it was just like being with one of your buddies. And he has hunting knowledge, and so you could bounce ideas off him, and we were just there to get a bull on film. And I went, and I, you know, I'm so dialed on my shooting and execution on animals, but all of us can miss. And I happened to miss twice on that hunt on film. So I had one bull. We worked really hard. The elk hunting was really good. We actually averaged on our iPhones, we averaged like over 16 miles per day of hunting. We were just going like banshees out there. We just hardly get home and have dinner, or get back to the, we were truck camping. And so we truck out of the camp, then leave per day and go hunt. But every day we were on bulls and multiple bulls, and we hunted it in October. And I really like hunting bulls in October. And in fact, the last three or four bulls I've killed have been in October, because those bulls will still rut second estrus cycle cows. And so they'll still rut pretty good, but all the pressure's off. Everybody takes their bow hunting time for elk in September, the third week of September, second week of September, fourth week, whatever it is. And so by the time it gets to October, guys have already spent all their vacation. And so it's like I have the woods to myself with all these elk that are still rutting. And so we were just into elk. And like I say, I mean, we had days where we did over 20 miles. I think we averaged somewhere between 15 and 20 per day. We got there, of course, the stress is on a little bit, you know, I want to get one on film. We get over there and this place muds up really bad. And, we hunt in the rain the first day, just pouring down rain for a couple days, floods happening. We bury my truck in the mud and have to, just where we pulled off the road a little bit, and we're laying in the water and laying in the mud, trying to get chains on, trying to get the truck out. And so we battle that for a half a day, just cake all our stuff in water, you know? And so it was just one of those difficult hunts where the first couple days we were working so hard to get my truck unstuck and get out of there. And then we couldn't drive any of the back roads because it takes multiple days for them to dry out. And so we're stuck hunting off the main access all season road in there, you know, which is good hunting off there, but you can't take any of the spurs or get back. But, I did have a couple misses. I had, so I had one bull that, so it was, you know, I had a good range on them, and we were in on, gosh, 125, 150 elk, 10 different bulls. And we kind of coyoted them all morning, keeping the wind right, and finally caught them in this gulch and finally got them in range where we had some cows at 30, 40, some bulls out farther. And finally this nice big six comes around to come rut these cows, and they're glucking in the background and bugling. It's just epic footage. It's just like, oh, here it goes. It's going to happen. It's going to be perfect. I tell them I'm going to shoot, get on the bull, and arrange the bull, and I draw back, and as I draw back and get back to full draw, that bull takes a couple steps, you know, diagonally at me or whatever. And so then when I loose, you know, his distance was 2 yards or 3 yards closer than where I had ranged him. And so I held right on his body and execute, and the shot breaks and skips right over top his back. Mm-hmm. Not just like, oh man. And then you know, not only did you miss or were you by yourself and you got to come back and tell your buddies, now you got it for the whole world to see out there. You miss on, you know, and I just hate to miss no matter what, but it just happens with all of us, you know. Oh, it's just conditions and the way things go. And it's hunting out west. And so I missed that bull. And then I actually had another bull that I missed as well, where we bedded him. He was in a great spot, and we snuck all the way around him, had the wind right, coming down in on him. And we get to about that 50-yard mark or something like that, and I had ranged the tree that he was bedded by, but I couldn't see the bull yet. Well, the bull got up and tried to get out of there. He had heard us. I think the grass was a little noisy. Maybe the wind laid off a little bit. Plus, you're trying to get two guys into range. And so he heard me and almost busted out of there. But right as he's going through my one opening I have to shoot, I draw back and give him a, ew, you know, and he stops right in that opening where I can see his vitals. And so I had ranged the tree. I didn't have a good yardage on the bull. And same thing. I shot and must have misjudged the yardage for, you know, 5 yards or whatever it was. He was, you know, I can't remember exactly if he was 5 yards in front of the tree or 5 yards behind the tree, but, you know, rewatch the footage. At first I thought I hit him, but, you know, executed a good shot, just didn't have a good range. And I'm just horrible. If I don't have an exact yardage on an animal, I just, my chances are probably, you know, 10 or 20% of actually killing that animal. Even when they're close. I'm just not very good at judging yardage. I love to have an exact yardage from my rangefinder. And so just another lesson learned, another miss on film, you know, I had to swallow a nice 6 point, but we just kept hunting hard, kept getting into bulls. And like I say, mile after mile, and cameraman was into it and I was into it. We were coming down to our last few days there, just exhausted every night and up before daylight, a couple hours hiking and chasing bulls all day long. Just a dream hunt for elk. And then we caught a nice 6-point. It was a solo bull that was coming up. Satellite bull trying to join up with the herd, and really nice six both sides, and he came up and we were kind of able to play the game and use this ridge line as cover and then get there and able to get a great shot on him, got it on film, just executed, put it on him, hit the heart, the arrow hit the offside shoulder, and then the bull ran right at us. And so he ran right at us and ran right by us at about 15 yards with the arrow just right in the perfect spot right there, and ran right over the hill where we couldn't see him, and then piled up right there, you know, didn't go 100 yards or 120 yards. And so it's pretty cool. Those really tough hunts, grueling hunts, couple misses, hiking so many miles, stuck in the truck, trying to get it all on film. Like, all that adds into the experience. And the more I can suffer and the more I can embrace the hunt, I just the more I enjoy it. And so that was a really cool experience for me.
Yeah, that sounds
perfect.
Neat. Yeah,
it's perfect. The more you suffer, the more you enjoy it. It's freaking spot on.
Yeah,
that's backcountry bow hunting, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
With those misses, Brian, are you rethinking anything specific? I know it's, you know, so easy to play armchair quarterback, to look at things, to go, wish I would have, could have, should have, whatever. But really, I mean, you personally, how have you taking those misses forward? Are you going to rethink your strategy for ranging or anything specific that comes to mind? Or it's just, you think you made the right moves, but it just, you know, it didn't go your way with the ranges.
You know, I think it's just more attention to detail in that crunch time. And, you know, you get those chances over and over again. And so, yeah, I mean, I just like to analyze them and look at them and look at what went wrong. And I, you know, and if I flubbed the shot or messed up my execution, I'd say so, you know. But I know the mistake on that first bull was he took 2-3 steps after I had ranged him and I didn't adjust my pin hold at all. So, you know, I think it's just, it's paying attention to those details. And when that bull walks, you know, I should have said, okay, you know, he's not at 55 now, he's at 52, or, you know, and I should have held low on the brisket and tried to execute that shot there. And so I think it's just paying attention to those little details in the crunch. The other one, it was just a guess of yardage. You either got the shot right there or you don't get a shot. And so, you know, I don't really sit back and say I shouldn't have taken the shot. But I just know if I don't get a good range, I'm not going to have much of a chance to hit him. Now, I had ranged the tree. I thought he was about the exact distances of the tree. But it was just one of those shots where you're taking a chance, you know, you either get it right or you get it wrong, and you definitely don't want to hit anything bad. And I don't want to shoot any unethical shot. If I loose an arrow, I want to harvest that animal that I'm shooting at. But, you know, through the five animals, the five Pope and Young trophies that I harvested last year, those were the only two misses I had. And so, you know, I don't overthink it. I don't lose my confidence at all in it. Helps me when I know what went wrong, when I know he took a couple steps and I missed. Like, if I would have just shot over his back and he wouldn't have taken those steps, or I wouldn't have put the pieces together, I maybe would have questioned things a little bit more. Like, did I punch the trigger? Was the bow not aiming right? And it's so tough. Like, shooting at animals, we just don't get that much practice at it. You know, it's like you work all year and you practice at targets and you try to put pressure on yourself, shooting with buddies, shooting 3D shoots. You try to up your skill level as high as you can. But the truth is once season gets here, I mean, you may only get one shot at a muley. You may get zero, or, you know, maybe it's a good year where, you know, or something happens where you get two or three, but you just don't get that many opportunities in the crunch. And so you have to really analyze those opportunities you do get and what went right and what went wrong. And in that fog of adrenaline too, your bow just doesn't aim the same. You know, your pin wants to wander a little bit more. And so I just always, like, as I'm stalking, I'll have a mantra that I'll repeat to myself. Like, you know, a lot of times mine will be pull, 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 you know, and I'll just say that over again to myself, or aim, 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 you know, just a couple mantras, like just things that sit inside my head to execute a good shot. And then my biggest thing is when I'm drawing my bow back, I make a conscious effort that I am going to execute a good shot. And so, you know, it's almost like you don't let the adrenaline get a hold of you, because your first few animals that you miss, you draw back and you're so dang excited to be getting an opportunity that your pin barely gets on that animal and you punch the trigger off and who knows where that shot goes. Or a lot of times you just want to get a shot so bad. You've been working for days and days and days to loose an arrow that you just want to loose that arrow, whether you hit it or not. And then once you miss, then you go, gosh, I wish I could have that shot back. Now all I want is redemption. And so, like, I think it's just this conscious effort to make sure that you're doing the small steps along the way, that you are going to execute a good shot, that you're just not going to find hair with your pin and punch it off. And so for me, I just let that pin aim. Like, even if that pin is right where you want it for a second, like, even if I can just keep it there for 2, 3, 4 seconds. And for me, you know, I shoot like a back tension style where I want to just let it aim in that middle and just keep pulling. But even for trigger guys, or even if you have to make a shot go, just really let that pin settle in. And we've all heard pick a hair, pick a spot, but really try to aim that pin for right where you want it, because you never get that shot back, and getting another opportunity can be way down the road. And so you just want to execute the absolute best shot you can on a critter when you do get a chance.
Yeah, man, so much great advice in there.
Yeah, some great info. So you use a back tension, just thumb trigger, or straight?
Yep. So I use a thumb trigger for when I'm hunting. You know, I do mess around with some other releases, shooting indoor and things, a hinge release. And then I started by learning a back tension release. And so, you know, you can't just trade a trigger for a thumb, you know, if you punch your trigger. And when you punch your trigger, you can shoot good on a punch shot. But what happens is your brain starts to anticipate that shot. And so all of a sudden your brain won't let you aim in the middle of the bullseye anymore. It'll, like, mine would hang low on a 3D target. And so, and it would just hold so rock steady, but it'd hold about 6 inches too low. And so I'd have to fight it up, and then make my release go. And so I just realized quite a few years ago that I had some target panic that was creeping up on me. And it was like, well, how do I correct this? And so I read a bunch. I talked to some of these tournament shooters, some of my buddies that are really good shots. And I just said, you know, what do I need to do? And I listened to their advice, and they had me go to a back tension style release where tension actually breaks the shot. And what it does is just retrain your brain to let you aim at the middle. Now, you don't know when the shot's going to break. All you do is you put the pin on the middle and then pull, and then the shot breaks within 2 to 5 seconds, 2 to 7 seconds of aiming at it, but you don't know where exactly. But it seems to be on animals, like, you're so hyped up and you pull so hard that you don't have to wait for your shot too long. If you execute correctly, like, you're waiting maybe 1 to 3 seconds and your shot's off and gone. But what you do is you practice with that back tension, and you start with blind bailing and shooting, not even aiming at a target, and you just pull till the shot breaks, and then you incorporate aiming at a target, and then you just let your pin, and instead of your pin hanging low, you let your pin just aim at the middle, and you let it move around, and you just keep pulling on that release, and the shot breaks. And it's a way more consistent way to shoot archery, and you'll find that your groups will shrink, and also you'll find that your good and bad days will mesh together to more of a medium shot. Like, you won't have bad days, and you don't really have good days either. They're all the same. You just shoot really consistent, really even keel, but you have to retrain your brain to be able to let it aim at the middle. And then from that back tension release, what I did is I transferred over to a thumb release, and a thumb release is the same way, where you just stick your thumb on that trigger, and you can shoot a trigger release back tension style just by wrapping to your first knuckle or your second knuckle and pull as you let your pin aim. It's the same theory, but I had developed bad habits with the trigger release. And so, you know, I went to that back tension. Now I shoot a thumb. And I just put tension on that thumb trigger, and then I start pulling with my back muscles, and I let that pin aim, whether it's on an animal or whether it's on a target. I let it aim, and I let that shot break, and it just allows me to aim so much better. And now a thumb release, you know, I talk about this back tension style, but there is a need on a bull elk or on a buck when he stops at 30 yards and looks back and this is your window, or, you know, you got to make a shot go with a, you never forget how to punch the trigger. Yeah. Like you can, you can punch a thumb just the same, or like me, you find little tricks where you can squeeze your hand together, or you put more pull on your thumb to make that shot go. So you can make your shots go quicker, and then you can also downright cheat them if you want and punch your trigger at 20 yards if you've got a bull and you got one opening and you need to make that shot go. Or a lot of times in the wind, shooting that back tension style, it won't let you aim at the middle as much, and so you got to almost make it go a little bit more by squeezing your hand or actually punching the trigger off. And you never forget how to do that, but you just always practice with really good technique. And then on those animals, I am always trying to, like, if I shoot back tension style, I very rarely miss, you know, whether it's, you know, if I do miss, it's because of a range. It's because of a, you know, one time I tried to range a buck and I got the tree behind his horns and I wasn't getting his horns. So he stood up and I sent one over his back. But if I execute correctly and I got a good range, you know, I believe in myself wholeheartedly that that animal is going to die and I'm going to hit him square in the middle and he's not going to go far. And so it just gives you a lot of confidence. And so I started shooting that style and it's really been good for me and beneficial.
Nice. What do you do with the release? Do you put it in a pocket? Do you put a wrist strap on it?
Yep.
Because I've looked at doing a thumb trigger, but I'm just like, I can't wrap my head around where that release is going to be and not just having quick access to it if I do need to make a quick shot.
So I've got a spot in my bino harness where mine goes, and it goes in there. Now, the cool thing about a thumb, the advantage you get from a trigger, so there's a split second when you're about ready to shoot and you range that animal and you've got to look down at your string loop and click in your release. Well, on a thumb release, you can click it to your string loop and be hunting with it on your string loop. So now all of a sudden you can range and you don't got to take your eyes off that buck or bull and you can reach down and grab that thumb and it's already hooked up. So you skip a step from a trigger. It makes you quicker and you don't have to take your eyes off that animal. And so it actually adds to it that way. But I've got a spot in my bino harness that sits right on the side that I put it. I have never lost a release. And so I'm one of the lucky ones, I think. I've heard of guys leaving $200 releases laying in the brush out in places. But, yeah, you know, and even in my front pocket, that doesn't bother me at all. Because what happens is once you start to get inside of 100 yards, you're clicking in that release and that release is on your string loop. So you no longer have to worry about where it's at or easy access to it because you're all hooked up ready to rock. All you got to do, keep your eyes on that animal and reach down and grab it. And you're ready to pull back and anchor.
So you've never worried about bumping it on something and having it, you know, release off the string loop while you're stalking? No,
I've never had that happen. I do. Okay. You know, I am a little OCD, a little paranoid. I am always looking down at my release to make sure I don't do that. But I can't remember a time where I bumped mine off. I mean, maybe once in the field where I've bumped it and it came off and I saw it or something. But I mean, out of 50 or so animals or stocks or, you know, I haven't knocked it off once. And inside 100 yards, I feel completely confident having it hooked up to my string loop and going. It's pretty secure on there. So, no, I don't worry about it too much. I do look at it as I'm stalking, you know, to make sure it's there. But, no, I haven't had any issues with it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I'm 100% the same, Brian. Like, everything you've said in the past 5 or 10 minutes on this whole topic has been my experience over the past, like, 3 to 4 years of dealing with holding low, trying to get my pin up, you know, punching a trigger, moving to a complete hinge release, doing the complete reset with blank baling, and then now hunting with a hinge the last 2 or 3 years now. So, man, it's been the same process for me. So it's good to hear that I'm not the lone guy out there who struggled through that for sure.
Oh, good for you. So you've been through the entire process as well, and now you're on the other side of it where you're shooting that hinge release effective on animals.
Yeah. Yeah. Shooting the thumb trigger, but yeah, I have it set heavy, totally use essentially, you know, back tension to execute. Like you said, if you have to, you can always fire one off. But yeah, that's the other thing with me too, and what you were talking about, Steve. At least with my release, it's very adjustable, and my thumb trigger, in terms of if you just want to push the trigger to unlock it, is pretty stinking heavy. So for me, I'm the same way with you, Brian. If I'm in a hunting situation, if game's spotted, if I think I'm even close to making a move, being close to firing off a shot, I'm the same way. I just lock it on, and I don't really worry about bumping it off either. And like you, I don't use a binocular harness much, so I typically just carry mine in my front pocket or even in my my waist belt pouch on my XO pack. So yeah, it works out well for me.
You guys carry an extra one?
I do. Yeah. I've never had to dig it out, but I do have an extra one.
I do the same. I haven't had to dig mine out, but I have it.
That's what I thought about using it last year because I've been fighting target panic. It's just gotten progressively worse for the last 3 years, and I shoot really good with thumb trigger, but I just couldn't when it came to hunting. I've just been trained with my wrist strap that, and then I started thinking about, oh, what if I freaking lose it? It could fall out of my pocket pretty easy. You're going to have to carry a spare. But I guess that is what it is.
Yeah.
Well, and you get so used to having it and checking your pocket and making sure it's there, looking at your bow, like you're pretty aware that that is your answer to killing an animal. So you pay really good attention to it. So yeah, I haven't lost it yet, but yeah. And that, that target panic, it seems to reach us guys that shoot a lot. Like the more you shoot and the more you aim at targets, the more it affects us guys. And, there are ways to kind of cheat it. And like you say, if you shoot a thumb during your practice or practice, then you can go to a trigger and then you aim a trigger really well, but then it starts to creep in again after a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks, it seems like. So, so I'm with you. We've all battled it. It sounds like all three of us have battled it before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're actually going to have an episode later this summer, kind of all about target panic and that whole process. So for you listeners who are kind of interested in all that, we will be kind of taking a deep dive into that. So hopefully you look forward to that one. Brian, I can't believe it's been an hour already. I feel like we could just keep going for a few more, but before we wrap things up, anything you want to share with us? Anything our listeners should go check out? Anything to stay tuned for? You mentioned the Eastmans films that you've recorded. Where are those going to be released? Kind of keep us up to date on where we can stay up to date with you, stay up to date with Eastmans, maybe check out some of your future hunts and things like that.
Yeah, for sure. So I believe those two episodes, the Mule Deer and the Elk, are going to be on Eastman's Hunting TV, and I think they're going to be on this season. I haven't got an exact date yet, but I know the footage is extremely high quality and the guys are excited about it. So we'll just be on the lookout for those on the Outdoor Channel. Check out the Eastman's Elevated podcast. And I just want to thank you guys for having me on, the first time and this time and being able to share information on this platform. You guys run such a great quality podcast and so good for your listeners. So thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I really enjoy talking to both of you guys.
Yeah. Thanks for the time, man. Where can folks find you on social media and things like that?
Yep. Social media. So on Facebook, Brian Barney, on Instagram, Brian Barney. And then I also have a Eastman's Elevated page, with all original content that I run on Instagram and Facebook. And I post to Instagram and then it automatically posts to Facebook, but I try to keep up and it's just, they're just fun platforms to be able to watch and keep up with other hunters and like-minded guys out there, and seems to be all positive. So I really enjoy it, but yeah, that's where you can find me, Instagram or Facebook.
Okay. Perfect. So last
question. No Snapchat.
Yeah.
I'm not that high tech yet. The Snapchat and Twitter aren't really for me, but yeah, Instagram and Facebook. I think so too.
This could be, opening up a whole new can of worms, but without, starting a 1 hour discussion that I'm probably going to want to have when you answer this final question, what's the one hunt that you're most looking forward to in 2017?
Boy, that is a tough one. I've got some good ones coming up. I mean, for me, the high country mule deer is everything. So I didn't do very good in the draws this year. I blanked in a lot of states. It's just getting tougher and tougher, and more guys are enjoying what we love and finding out about it. But you just got to be more creative. You got to put in for more states, save your points, put in for the units you want to draw, and then just be creative, like with the second choice and over the counter. So I'm actually coming to Steve's neck of the woods this year. I've got an over the counter Idaho tag, and Idaho is like my last state that I have left to harvest a mule deer. I haven't got one in Washington and Oregon. Washington, I harvested a blacktail, and I haven't been to Nebraska or the Dakotas out there. But as far as, you know, Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Montana, so Utah, you know, so I've got all these states checked off my list, Nevada, but Idaho is my last stronghold. And so this year I didn't do very good in the draws, so I picked up an Idaho over the counter. I got this spot I've been looking at for years. And so I actually, one year I ran a scouting trip in there and was going to hunt it. And then I ended up drawing Nevada on a second choice and ended up putting my focus there. So I've actually got a spot that I've done a little bit of research in, and then I've just been piling over the maps in Google Earth. And then we're going to do this death hike here next weekend, which I'm really looking forward to. And then I've got a couple weekends scouting that I'm going to get in there and see what lives in there and see if I can find some next level bucks. So I would say I'm looking most forward to that, but I mean, I've got a big season plan. I'm going to go do caribou with my buddy up in Alaska. We're going to go do the Hall Road. So it's like a cheap $1,000 trip, which I'm really into. Go do the Hall Road, fish for Arctic char and hunt caribou. You know, I think it's 3 or 5 miles either side of the Hall Road is bow hunting only. We're actually going to put in and drift a river up there from his truck, leaving a little motorcycle down at the bottom and floating this river system where we can kind of fish and hunt caribou, and then we can relocate if we need to. So looking forward to that. I got antelope tag August 15th here in Montana, go into that high country mule deer. I drew the same elk tag again this year, so I'm going to go back there. Late season muleys in Montana, found this really cool spot last year. So it's general rifle season where I'm hunting, but they allow me to hunt with a bow. So I have to hunt with orange on, I hunt with my bow, and it's general rifle season. So there's, you know, who knows how many thousands of guys out there hunting with rifles, but there's these, you know, everybody kind of hunts off the road and the easy to go to spots. And so I backpacked into this spot last year, and I was seeing, you know, like in a weekend of hunting, 2-3 days of hunting, I counted 25 different bucks, and I'm starting to see those next level older, more mature deer in there. And I went back with my dad and got him a really nice deer the weekend after I shot mine. He hunts with a rifle, and so we went in and got a really nice buck that was aged at 6.5 in there, that was a really nice dark heavy horn, and I killed a decent 4 in there, but I saw bigger and chased bigger. And I'm just getting back in there and I'm camping like I would a backpack hunt, and I just away from everybody in there. I've got it all to myself, and it's kind of, you know, it's more rolling coulees and timber patches and things. You know, it's not the extreme high country, but there's a lot of deer in there, and we get to hunt them right during the rut in November, the peak of the rut. And so really looking forward to hunting that. And then I didn't draw a late tag, but I think I've gone down to Arizona like for 3 years and hunted coos down there and killed a really nice coos with my bow down there at Spot and Stock. And that's really cool. You're just down in the desert terrain, you know, down around Mexico. And I leave Montana and it's 20 below, and down there it's 60, 70 degrees. And there's nobody doing it with bows and arrows down there. I mean, there's guys that do it, and I know there's hardcore guys, but at least the area that I've found, there's nobody in it. And I'm seeing 20 coos a day and 4 or 5 different bucks. And just like I was talking axis deer, once you start seeing them, you know, they're not on a food source. They're just spread out all the way through this desert terrain. And so you just get up there in these desert mountains that actually go fairly high, and just glassing and spotting and stalking. And it's right during the middle of the coos rut, so it's the best chance to hunt them. And you know, you see 110, 120 inch coos, you know, really heavy, and you just get to appreciate the species and kind of embark on another adventure. So looking forward to doing that. I got a buddy I go with that we've been down there 3 years. So looking forward to that. So that was the long answer to your question, as I named all the hunts I'm doing, but I'm just so excited for the season and what I have coming up. And you just got to be more creative and build points in other states. And really thought I was going to draw Colorado this year and didn't. And there still is an opportunity to pick up a leftover tag that comes up August 1st. And so, you know, I may look to back-to-back that one in Idaho if I get really crazy. Hopefully I don't get fired from my job, but just really enjoy all the Western hunting that we have out here and try to do as much as I can do, you know, with still getting some work done along the way.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome. Well, Brian, thanks again for joining us. We'll be sure to follow what's going to be an awesome year for you.
Yeah. And thanks again, guys. Can't wait to meet you in person on this hike. Again, really looking forward to it.
Well, guys, thank you so much again for tuning in. As you heard, we are off to the death hike and hope to record some content while we're out there and kind of have a post-hike debrief. As well, we have so many amazing guests lined up in the next several weeks. Thank you guys so much for tuning in. Be sure, if you haven't yet, to subscribe to receive the latest episodes. You can do that in iTunes or Stitcher. If you have any other questions about that, shoot us an email, or as always, head to exomountaingear.com/podcast to get all the links and all the information you need. Until next time, have a great week.